So welcome everyone to this March 2:10 retreat on the Anapanasati, Full Awareness of the Breath Sutra, which I know has a very highfalutin. Oh, this is... So again, is that better? Welcome everyone to our March 2:10 four-day retreat on the Anapanasati Sutra. This is the second retreat we've given. How many of you were at the fall retreat? Better, how many weren't? Okay, so a good number weren't. So we're half and half. So I'll... That's helpful. We're here at the Franciscan Center. We had a very nice welcome from the sister yesterday, and I talked with her a little bit afterwards. Kindred hearts of the spirit, truly. And we know the Franciscan, not that I know anything really about it, but I do. Read years ago St. Francis, and I know this is an order that has always exemplified simplicity. Deep caring for the poor, and great affinity with animals and nature. So probably if St. Francis had been born in Asia, he probably would have been considered a great bodhisattva, great master in the Buddhist tradition. But so he became a great master in the Christian tradition, and so became a saint. But it's good to be here. And it's lovely to be here in Florida springtime. you know, many people, when they think of Florida, they think of hot. You know, like we have one season or something. But those of us who live in Florida know, well, we have a very wonderful spring. And so it's wonderful to be with azaleas. And daffodils, for those of us who might have emigrated from northern climes, we know that daffodils are associated with spring. So it's wonderful to touch the beauty of springtime. My hope is to spend a little time today kind of entering the sutra again, and since a number of you weren't at the first one, just to go through it a little more quickly, what we covered last time, and then to move ahead. My hope, we'll see, for the first 2 days is to go directly into the sutra, and then the last 2 days to read from the teachings of Tang, T-A-N-G-H-O-I. Any sense? And it has little marks above it. Tang Hoi, who Thich Nhat Hanh wrote a book with commentary on his teachings, and really holds him in high esteem because it appears that Tang Hoi was both a great monk in the Mahayana tradition, but also was connected with the earlier Buddhist teachings, such as found in the Anapanasati Sutra. So brought them both together, and my sense is that Thich Nhat Hanh really looks to him as an exemplar for him, of somebody who brought together these various streams. And also, I think it was sung through Tang Hoi that Thay was able to really get access to this sutra. So for the last 2 days, I'll share some of Tang Hoi's teachings. I brought, I think many of you know that there are close to 50 of people in our community who've been involved in 6 or 8 months of continuing study and practice of this sutra. And we're using two books, Thich Nhat Hanh's book, Breathe, You're Alive, and Larry Rosenberg's book, Breath by Breath. And I brought them both here because, especially part of the sutra we're going to get into today, which has lists, you know, 5 of this and 6 of this, again, these are, you know, everybody is translating. And it's just very interesting to look at, and most of these Sanskrit and Pali words do not have exact translations into English, because they are the kind of languages in which one word may have many layers of meaning. So often you find the translators having to choose one English word for a whole kind of concept. They're on the mark, but not really on the mark. So it's good to kind of look at how different people, because I think it gives different shades of meaning. So I'll begin with Thay's translation. And I won't read it word for word. I'll sort of paraphrase it, because I know a lot of you were here at the one, at the retreat in October, and many of you perhaps had listened to some of those talks on the web. So it begins. It's a sutra. Sutra means it purports to be the exact teachings of the Buddha. As most usually recorded by his cousin, Ananda, who had a very astute capacity for memory. And also because he was attendant and constantly with him, he was able to hear many of the Buddha's talks. And I'm sure over time, the Buddha, like many teachers, said the same thing over and over again, so Ananda was able to hear the teaching many times. But whenever you heard most sutras, they begin with, I heard these words of the Buddha. Or sometimes in sutras, they say, thus I have heard. And when you hear thus I have heard, it is really saying that someone is saying, I actually heard the Buddha speak these teachings. And so when the Buddhist council, first Buddhist council, met after the passing, the parinirvana of the Buddha, the way, and there were, you know, many people had heard many teachings, the way a teaching was authenticated was putting this little phrase. So this means this is a real teaching of the Buddha. He really said this. Oh, by the way, I brought some friends with me to retreat, saying parinirvana. I realize I have not many, but several, or somewhere between several and many, different kinds of Buddhas in my home, and I realize I always bring the same ones to retreat. And so these are on our altar. We have there are eight great events in the Buddha's life, of which there are four major ones, and here we have three of them represented. The Tanka. Tanka is a Tibetan word for that scroll. That's the Buddha. And below him are major of his disciples. And the Buddha is in the earth-touching mudra. And it was interesting, you know, that this morning when we did Touching the Earth, the teaching was about the earth and the Buddha's connection to the earth and our connection to the earth. And we know that it was instructive that when the Buddha, prior to his enlightenment, was under the Bodhi tree, and when Mara, really the force of delusion, was assailing him, trying to unsteady him, trying to scare him, trying to seduce him, trying to do anything it could to distract him. And again, we all know that, right? Because we sit cultivating stability and insight and concentration, and we find the forces of Mara besiege us, don't they? They arise in our own mind. And sometimes there are thoughts, fearful thoughts, and sometimes there are desirous thoughts, and sometimes there are self-doubt thoughts, and so all these types. So we know this is also the Buddha experience, except in tradition it's personified as Mara. You know, this demon of delusion was assaulting the Buddha. And at one point, after Mara had kind of unleashed all his usual ammunition at the Buddha, and he was unshakable, he finally kind of went, who do you think you are, right? That you think that you can attain full enlightenment. Who do you think you are that you can penetrate to this depth of understanding? Who do you think you are that you could develop the capacity and have the capacity to help all beings and enlighten all beings? I mean, he kind of went right. He kind of really tried to shake him off. The Buddha sits on the Vajra seat, the throne of enlightenment, or the adamantine throne is where the Buddha was sitting. So he was trying to knock him off, and he tried all the ways. And the interesting thing is, at that point, what the Buddha did, he was sitting in meditation, and he simply just put his hand down and touched the earth. And he let the earth kind of testify for him. Interesting. He let the earth testify for him. And what the earth testified in that moment was in that all the prior births, all the prior lives of the Buddha, there wasn't one square foot or inch or yard or something of land that the Buddha had not given himself unstintingly for the benefit of beings. So we know that the career of a bodhisattva is not simply mental training. Not simply meditation training. It is also an unceasing activity of benefiting others, even sacrificing oneself for others. And we know we are all called upon in this life. And it's not like it has to be big time. It's not simply Mother Teresa sacrifice. Or giving up one's life kind of sacrifice, which the Buddha did do in his prior lives. But it also means all the times that we're called upon to give up our selfishness, our self-centeredness, and to put somebody ahead of us, right? To put somebody else's well-being ahead of our own, put somebody's happiness ahead of our own, to put somebody's desire and need ahead of our own. That kind of sacrifice is the career of the bodhisattva. It is the career of non-self. It is the capacity of living from that place of non-self, as opposed to always living from that place of ego. So the Buddha puts his hand to the earth, and supposedly there was I don't quite remember how it happened, what exactly occurred, but there was a great outpouring of support, and Mara was banished. So that earth touching, that the earth bearing witness, and also please remember that if you read the prior lives of the Buddha, as often told in the Jataka tales, we know that he had many, many lives as an animal, as a bird and a deer and all different kinds of animals. So we should be very careful how we treat our brother and sister animals in this life. Could be a future Buddha there. So that tanka, and then that small Buddha. It's quite beautiful Buddha. It's an old Buddha. You pick it up, it's quite heavy. It's quite wonderful. I actually got that Buddha in Maine maybe 30, 40 years ago. I was in vacation up in Maine and going through some little town, some little half-block town, and there was a little Maine gift shop in it. I was just walking down the street, and there was something Asian in the window. Right away, everything else was sort of lobster kind of stuff. So that piqued my curiosity, and I went in, and there he was sitting on a shelf. And I looked at him, and I knew he was very special, the real thing. And the story was, it was a young couple who ran the store, and their grandfather had died recently, and he was an old Maine sea captain. And he must have picked this up at some, I think it was a whale or something, you know, when he had been in China at some point. He just picked it up, and they were kind of cleaning out his house, and they found this thing, and they kind of stuck it in their shop. So so I was very lucky to meet him. And then in the middle is the Buddha, a wooden hand-carved Buddha. It's a Buddha in the teaching mudra. So, you know, after... the four great events of the Buddha's life were, of course, his birth, his enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, turning the wheel of the Dharma, first turning, teaching mudra. So when the Buddha, after his great enlightenment, went to Sarnath to find the five disciples that he'd been practicing with and began his first teaching, in which he elucidated the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, that's the teaching mudra. And then finally, this is... Parinirvana. This is the Buddha's passing. And especially in Southeast Asia, you see many statues of that, images of that. Some quite large. I don't know if as large as this whole room, but some of them are quite large. He's comfortable. He's not afraid. He's at ease in his passing. And actually, I think I got that in Laos. So those are our friends who are with us. So this sutra in the full awareness of breathing. So the Buddha is in Sravasti, and you can go there today, and you can see the ruins of. The various monasteries and places where the Buddha and his disciples lived and taught. These are historical places. And so he was there in retreat, the same way we are, except he was there in their traditional, because of the nature of the rainy season in India, one, because it is very difficult to get around, it's very muddy, and a lot of floods and things like that, as well as because of the rains and the heat, there were a lot of insects. And so when you walked around, you could be more capable of killing something. So for various reasons, the monks and the Buddha didn't move around. So they would stay in one place for 3 months. And so they were all gathered together. And they were living as a community, but they were also teaching each other. And it says the older bhikkhus, which means the monks, the ordained monks, were teaching the younger ones in groups of, some were instructing 10, some 20, some 30. So you can see it was a gathering of maybe 400, but within it there were small groupings of teachers and students. And then at the end of the 3 months, the Buddha spoke to the gathered community, and he really just said, I am delighted the way you're practicing. You are just practicing so deeply and so harmoniously that I'm going to extend this retreat for another month. And word got out that the Buddha was doing that, and so hundreds and hundreds of more disciples came to Svartthi. And they practiced together for another month. And then the Buddha, at the end of that next month, on the full moon day, he addressed. And please remember, it's interesting, you know, the bhikkhus and bhikshunis, the monks and nuns in those days, they were not involved with monasteries. They were not involved with rituals. They were not involved with death ceremonies, which a lot now you see, if you go to Asia, you see that is the work of the monastics. You know, they're very busy doing these kinds of things. But in those days, they really just practiced. And their life was very simple. They were fully devoted to meditative practice. And their relationship with the lay community, people like us, was really, they looked to us for support. They had no kitchens. So every day, wherever they were, they went for food. And they just ate what they, you know, was today very much probably like the early Franciscans lived that way. And but in return for the food, they would often give some Dharma instruction to the lay person who had offered them food. And that really was the relationship. It was quite wonderful. Each gave nurturance to each other, right? The lay community gave food to the monastics, and the monastics gave Dharma. So they both sustained each other. And after that, they would return to wherever they were encamped, and they would practice. And usually, I think on most days, the Buddha would address them at some point, giving instruction. And also, if he had lay disciples, they may gather around too. And that's really how they lived, very simply, and totally devoted to practice. And a lot of the later, again, aspects that we see of the Buddhist monastic tradition now has really grown over the years, but it was not the way the Buddha did it. So he looks over the community, says, "Our community is pure and good. At its heart, it is without useless and boastful talk." And it's interesting that he focuses on that. He doesn't say you're all deep practicers. You know what I mean? There's so many other ways he could have complimented them. I think it's interesting that he says, you're pure and good, and you don't have useless and boastful talk. So obviously he was trying to say something there, because he could have said anything to compliment them. He said, so that's obviously very meaningful to them. And obviously I would imagine that a lot of the other spiritual communities that were around in those days and that he had participated in were full of a lot of useless and boastful talk. Right? And hopefully, you know, useless talk means what? Talk that has no use. And we know there are a lot of people like that, who just talk for the sake of talking. You don't even have to be listening to them, and they'll keep talking. You know, it's right? It's like that. Or else people are boastful, you know, always telling, you know, all the wonderful things they're doing, and they're the best at this. And I'm sure in spiritual communities, people, you go there and they tell you all the wonderful things their community, they boast about their communities, they boast about their practice, etc. So we said, our community doesn't do that. It's not engaged in useless and boastful talking. And therefore, it's deserving of receiving offering, and it is a field of merit. He says, such a community is rare. And any pilgrim who seeks it, no matter how far he or she must travel, will find it worthy. So again, this is all teaching. You know, and whether we as a community or we as individuals, how can we take that to heart? To understand that we don't need to engage in endless, useless talk. And talk that only serves to boost our ego. Is not worthy of us, is not worth of a practitioner. And then he kind of enumerates, which I find very interesting, he enumerates the different levels of realization and practice of those who are gathered there. Before he talks about the full awareness of breathing. And I wanted to just spend a little time looking at that. He said there are arahats. Arahats are—they're like in the Mahayana, they're kind of one step under the bodhisattvas. They've destroyed every root of affliction, laid aside every burden, and attained right understanding. There are also bhikkhus who have cut off the five internal formation. Those who've thrown off the three internal formations and realized the fruit of returning once more. Cut off the roots of greed, hatred, and ignorance, thrown off the three internal formation, become a stream enterer. So what's going on here is very interesting, and I think it's helpful for us to know that there are markers in Buddhism where we can somewhat get a sense of how we're doing as practitioners. These 10 internal formations are caught in the wrong view of self, which means if one believes if one believes that the self exists and that it is permanent and self-existent, that would be a wrong view. Right? So if we are still caught in that, then we have not, then that internal formation or internal knot still is binding us. Second one is hesitation or doubt. And here we're talking about doubts either about the way, the path, or doubts about our own capacity. It is usually doubt that leads to hesitation. Now again, you know, on the one hand, the Buddhist path is very kind of free thinking. It says investigate, investigate, investigate. But at a certain point, you know, you have to draw some conclusions. I think that's the important point here. You know, maybe I've said this before, but I remember once meeting somebody who described themselves as a seeker. You know, I've been a seeker for 40 years. I remember them saying that. I've been a seeker for 40 years, to describe themselves. And my response was, I felt bad for them. Because if one is seeking for, if one is a seeker, one wants to find something, right? So at a certain point, a seeker has to be a finder. You know, it's good to be a seeker up to a certain point, but at a certain point, one wants to find that which was one seeking. And to think that this person had been at it for 40 years and it still hadn't found the sustenance of a path. You know, we're still just looking in this path and that path. And I mean, it could be an interesting life, an enjoyable life. I'm not saying that that may not be the case. This is a path of the many things in this path. But so we want to get beyond doubt. We want to get beyond the doubt that creates hesitation, because that prevents us from doing what we talked about yesterday, entering the river and letting the river carry us. As long as we're lost in doubt or lost in self-doubt, you know, I'm too sick, I'm too neurotic, I'm too screwed up, I'm too this, I'm too busy, I'm too, right? All the stuff that we endlessly throw up of why we cannot live fully in the present. There is no reason we cannot live fully in the present, because the present is always here. I mean, if there wasn't a present reality that all of us were experiencing from moment to moment, then we'd have a good excuse. But the present moment, this reality, is always here for us. So awakening is always available. Awakening is always possible for us to say we don't. Well, like Achan Shah once said to some very busy person who came to him and said, I just have no time to practice. And then Achan Shah looked at him and said, aren't you breathing? You know, I mean, this is full awareness of the breath. I mean, whatever you're doing, you are breathing. All you need to do is be aware of your breath. Right? So getting beyond excuses. Right? Up to a certain point, it's good to investigate the path. The Buddha said that himself. Investigate it. Make sure it makes sense to you. It's rational. It's logical. It's congruent with your experience. But once you, come to that conclusion, then practice. And if you don't come to that conclusion, find another path, right? I mean, it's not like a big deal, right? I mean, you know, if this path doesn't make sense to you or doesn't meet your needs, then find another path. Well, luckily, there are lots of paths out there, right? But at a certain point, one has to, get over the hump of doubt and hesitation. Not for any dogmatic reasons, but just for one's own benefit, right? So one can really reap the fruits of the path. third is caught in superstitious prohibitions and rituals. I mean, obviously that was much more prevalent in the time of the Buddha, but, you know, I mean, again, you know, do I not make a move without consulting my astrologer or, you know, my horoscope today? I don't know what else. I'm sure we can think of things, but in other words, am I free of all that? I mean, that stuff may be interesting. You can consult an astrologer. I'm not meaning to put down astrology, but it means we're not caught up in superstitious stuff. Prohibitions and rituals. Four is craving. You know, is my mind still full of desire? You know, and again, people, some of these teachings, they go lust. You know, like that's the big one. That's just one of many. Right? I mean, don't get too prideful, but you say, well, I'm not lustful. It's craving. Desire. You know, one can crave anything. You know, one can crave happiness. Right? One can crave a thing, a mind state, a person, an experience. So, you know, is my mind still always moving toward objects and wanting to attach to them? Is my mind still always going outside itself, looking for satisfaction and meaning in things or objects, people's relationships, experiences? Or is my mind at peace? Craving. And the opposite of kind of attaching is the fifth one, which is hatred or anger or aversion. Again, am I always pushing away? Am I always not wanting things to be? Am I angry? Am I irritated? You know, is my, as opposed to the craver who's always trying to attach and grasp, you know, at everything they see. You know, I got to go home and get an azalea bush for myself. You know, it's like it's the first thought. You know what I mean? Or where can I buy these? I mean, we haven't thought about daffodils in 5 years, and we see a daffodil, and all of a sudden, you know, I gotta have one. Right? Tanka the Buddha, gotta have one. Maybe I'll go to Maine and see what I can find. You know what I mean? That mind that cannot let an object arise without wanting it. You know, right? It's like that. How is that mind? So you can see, even though we are doing these meditative practices, we're cultivating mindfulness, you can see that the test, you know, for those of you who go, you know, I'm still such a lousy meditator, right? Well, that's not what it's all about. I mean, the practice of concentration, the practice of mindfulness is very important, but the Buddha's saying, this is the test. Is that clear? This is very important. This is the test. You know, what's going on in your mind and how it relates to life? That's where you'll find out, you know, how your practice is. You know, not that, I mean, it's good that you can say, well, I used to, I couldn't sit still and now I can sit still. Or I used to sit in the Burmese position, and now I can sit in the quarter lotus. And I used to sit in the quarter lotus, and now I can sit in the half lotus. I mean, you know what I mean? I mean, those things are good. But that's not what it's all about. This is what it's all about. Six, again, is a desire for the world of forms. It's just another way of talking about a desire for formless worlds. Again, forms are things we can touch and see. Formless are things more abstract. But we can still want them, right? We can still be unhappy, dissatisfied with where we are, and think our happiness will come either by gaining a thing or gaining a mind state, something that is formless. Either way, that kind of desire is unsettling to the mind. And then pride. Obviously, if we have pride, if we have arrogance, that only can exist with a strong self. There has to be a me, there has to be an I, and there has to be a me or my that stands in opposition to all the other me and my's and wants people to see them in a certain way. They want to look good in a certain way. They want to look worthy in a certain way. They want to be loved in a certain, you know what I mean? All that me, my stuff. Right? How am I doing on that? Right? Is that still the central core of my life? Or has that lessened over the years? Has that softened over the years? Is my life less about me and more about others? You know, when I encounter people, Doro, is the first thing what I want to do is tell them how I'm doing? Or am I interested in how they're doing? Sort of like that. It's like the locus of centrality of our life is no longer here. It's everywhere. Agitation, you know, is, and this is a mind state. It could also be physically. Is everybody kind of checking themselves as we're going through this? Good. This is what we're supposed to be doing, because this is, again, it's a yardstick. It's not, again, it's not something to beat ourselves up, but it's something just to look at, to see that these kind of lists, you know. Anybody who reads Buddha's teachings, you know, and we can see it. I'm just going to kind of run through them, because I'm not asking you to memorize them, but to understand that we can use these lists as a way to understand, you know, how our practice is doing. Right. Again, you know, is my mind always in an uproar? Am I always, you know, worrying about something, pissed off about something, distressed about something, concerned about, you know what I mean? Is my mind just always agitated? Right? Are the waters always stirred up? Or are the waters calm? Peaceful. Deep. Clear. Right? And the last of, this could be the first, is ignorance. Ignorance is what? Confusion, misperception, even even stupidity. It means what? That we don't see clearly, right? That we think what is wrong, we think is right, right? What we think is real is really unreal. What we think is permanent is really impermanent. What we think is really a source of suffering of happiness is really a source of suffering. In other words, are we ignorant? Do we have it all turned around backwards? Are we just all screwed up? Do we see clearly? You know, a wise person sees clearly. They have wisdom. They see things as they really are. Ignorant person can't see it. So do I still live in ignorance? And again, this is like a fundamental ignorance. Ignorance in Buddhism, the fundamental ignorance is ignorance of reality, of seeing truly the way things are. You know, the Buddha in his teaching, first teachings, talked about the three marks of existence. He said every phenomena is characterized by impermanence, non-self, and dukkha, or unsatisfactoriness. Do we see that? Do we see the presence of these three marks in everything that exists? If not, we're still ignorant. So it's like that. So when they talk about these various levels of never returners and three-time returners and one-time returners and like that, stream enterers in these categorizations, what they'll do, and you can read this for yourself, they'll say the arhat has cut off all 10. None of these 10 internal form knots are functioning within them. Next level, they've cut off 5. Next level, they've weakened. they've cut off the first 3, and they've weakened the other. Right. So as you read through these categories, you'll see they are ways for us to look at development and practice. And these are not just stories. These are not just ancient stories. These are categories that the Buddha postulated within his own community to give people a sense, you know, these are the people who have graduated from elementary school. These are the people who have graduated from middle school. These are the people who have graduated from high school. These are people who have their, you know, bachelor's degree. These are the ones who have their master's degrees. These are the PhDs, and these are the postdocs. I mean, it's like that. I mean, it's just so we don't think it's too strange. That's really what this is. You know, the Buddha is looking out at his community and saying to people, there is a way to check your development, to see where you are on my path. And again, we know the first one is called the stream enterer. And that relates to what we talked about last night about the river. The stream enterer is one who has had some glimpse into the nature of reality, so their ignorance has been diminished enough that they will enter the stream of awakening and will be carried along by it. They are no longer fettered by these ten the way they were. They have not eliminated them. They are not free of them. Right? It's sort of like, this may mean it's sort of like that light at the end of the tunnel. Right? If you're in the tunnel and there's no light, you don't know where you are, right? And you don't know how to get out. Has anybody been in a tunnel where there's no light at the end of the tunnel? It's quite dark, right? Quite dark. And kind of one has to feel one's way around. If anyone's ever been in complete darkness, knows that feeling. And if you forgot your flashlight, then you really know what that's like. But if there's a light, right, you know the direction clearly, right? And you know all you have to do is just keep walking toward that light, and you'll get there, because there's a light. Right? So this is sort of like the stream enterer. No longer are we fettered in the way, no longer is there complete darkness. Enough light has come into the mind, enough validation of the teaching, enough experience has occurred that one is absolutely sure of the validity of the teaching, of the path of realization, and one is a stream enterer, right? The stream now is carrying us. Up to this point, it was a struggle, right? Feel like in the jungle, you know, cutting the vines, tripping over the bushes, you know, just like that. Falling down, picking ourselves up, going down this one, going down that one, right? But finally we've made it to the stream. Right? We can enter the stream and now we can, right, in our little boat, or our big boat, or our raft, whatever we want to say. Now the stream will carry. You still may have to do some rowing, some navigating, you know. It doesn't mean that our part is over. But it's not always a one obstacle after the other testing us. The Buddha says that there are those in my community that are practicing the four right efforts. And I'll just kind of briefly go through them. One of these efforts is not to allow any occasion for wrongdoing to arise. Once an occasion of wrongdoing has arisen, to find a means to put an end to it. So how am I doing? Right? Am I doing less harm than I used to do? Right? To myself? The way I care for myself, my mind, my body? Right? Am I doing less harm? Less wrongdoing? In my relationship with others? Right? Less wrongdoing? And all of us know what that means. We're all well experienced in wrongdoing. We are professionals. Semi-professionals. In this gathering, we have professionals, semi-professionals, amateurs, all kinds. Each of us know where we are. So again, is there less wrongdoing in my actions of body, speech, and mind? And when there is wrongdoing, do I recognize it and do I put an end to it? You know what I mean? Am I getting better at seeing my wrongdoing when it occurs, acknowledging it, and changing it? Third is causing right action to arise when it has not already arisen. And fourth is finding ways to develop right action and make it last once it's arisen. So again, the other side is, how am I doing in cultivating actions of body, speech, and mind that create goodness, produce well-being, happiness for my body, for my life, for your life, for others, myself, right? Am I more able to do that? Am I more able to consciously find more occasions to do that? And once that has occurred and has arisen in me, how skillful am I in maintaining that in a consistent basis for a time? So those are called the four right efforts. Next are the... Here's an interesting one that some of the Buddhist people are practicing. The four bases of success. And we do like to succeed, don't we? We are a success-oriented people. So this is from the Buddha himself. So if we want to be successful at this practice, and here these are the practices that sustain and help us realize a strong mind. Do I want to develop a strong mind? And the four are diligence, energy, full awareness, and penetration. Let me see what... how it's translated in the other... Oh, it's interesting. You see... forgive me for being a little academic, but so in Thay's translation, the four bases of success are diligence, and in Rosenberg's he translates that as keen interest in doing the practice. That's the four. So the first one is keen interest in doing the practice. Second, it translates energy, and he translates this as persistence in the practice. Right? So if I want to be successful in developing a strong mind, right, am I really interested in that? Right? Do I have a real, genuine interest in developing myself in this way? Right? And then if I do have that, am I persistent? Am I energetic? Right? Is it on and off? Is it this and that? Come see, come sa. Or do I find that my interest in developing my mind in a certain way actually is fueling a consistency in my application? The next one is full awareness in Thay's translation, and in Rosenberg's it's intentness on the practice, wholeheartedness. So am I interested in the practice? Am I persistent in my practice? And then when I practice, is my practice wholehearted? Do I give myself fully to it? Or even when I come to the practice, I'm sitting here, but I'm, thinking about what happened before, thinking about what happened after, thinking about how I'm doing in the practice. Or am I really 100% with it? Right? Have I entered the stream? Or am I still on the outside? And the last one, Thai translate for success, is penetration. And Rosenberg calls it being discriminating in the practice, careful to see results of practice and make proper adjustments. So you can see there's a lot of freedom in translation. But again, you can see the, you can see how it develops. Interest, persistence, wholeheartedness, and then penetration. Do I go into it deeply? Careful to see results of practice and make proper adjustments. What is my relationship with my practice? Is it just something I do? Right? Kind of like an automaton? Right? Such as cooking, right? I mean, we can put together a meal, can't we? Right? It's not that hard. But are we, even when we go to the fridge and we look in to choose the ingredients, are we really present to each of the ingredients, right? Are we grateful that they're there and that someone has provided them for us? And when we take them out and as we do the preparation, are we really totally in that moment, in the chopping, in the cutting, in the stirring? Right? Do we want really it to be, even if it's simple, to be fresh, to be alive, to be tasty, to be pleasing, to be nourishing? That's a very different way of putting a meal on the table. It's the same meal, but the process is very different. So it's the same way with our practice, that which we call our practice. And again, you might, if you think about it, we feed ourselves every day, don't we? On an average, we do it 3 times a day. And even though, we just did it yesterday, or we just did it this afternoon, here we are again, right? And can we give that same aliveness and freshness and in the momentness to this meal, right? As if it's the only one. And it's the same way with our practice. When we sit down to practice, are we fresh? Are we stable? Are we open? If not, we should stop, right? If we find it's coming to prepare the meal and we're just kind of opening the fridge and that, we should stop, right? We should close the fridge, shouldn't we? Take some breaths. Breathing in, I'm aware. Then I'm here. Breathing out, I relax. Breathing in, I'm aware I'm about to cook, about to look at food. Am I grateful? Am I present? Am I aware? Like that. And if we're still not there, we shouldn't open up the fridge, should we? Like that. Do we approach our practice with that same care when we sit down to meditate, when we do our walking meditation? And again, like in Rosenberg's translation, do we kind of check it, right? So if we go out and we're doing walking meditation, all of a sudden we realize, I'm not here. I'm thinking about something, or I'm, right? That's okay. In that moment, you have touched awareness, because you are aware of what you're doing. Just stop. Right? Begin again. Because everything is empty of any permanence, because everything is changing moment to moment, that capacity to be fresh and to begin again is always available to us. That is the gift of non-self. That is the gift of emptiness. Nothing is fixed. So we can constantly renew. So these are what these guys are up to. And then they have the four foundations of mindfulness and the seven factors of awakening, but we will deal with that tomorrow, right? I think we have enough on our plate for one day. So let us move on into the sutra. So the Buddha, having enumerated all these and even more practices, there are people practicing on loving kindness and on compassion and on all and on and on. And there are those who are the five powers and the factors of awakening and the Noble Eightfold Path and are practicing joy and equanimity. There are those who are practicing the nine contemplations. You know, the nine contemplations are on the dissolution of the body. You know, they may be either imagining this, these nine stages of dissolution of the body, they're meditating on permanence and death, or they may actually be gone to a cremation site, very common, and meditating it in vivo with a dead body, but they're doing that type of a practice. And then finally the Buddha says, and there are those who are already practicing full awareness of breathing. Lots of trumpets at that point. Great. Flowers come down from the sky. It's quite a wonderful moment when the Buddha introduces, you know. as if. And again, it's obvious that these practices, and I think why people, especially Thai, and those of us who've been practicing the sutra for the past 6 months or so, it is not as if these teachings and practices have not been taught by the Buddha up to then. I think why this sutra is held in high esteem by many, he synthesizes them here. He brings together a whole series of meditation practices, the four foundations of mindfulness, impermanence, etc., non-self, and breath practice to stabilize. He brings it all together. And so this is very much the 60 meditations that are going to unfold for us are really a compendium of very many diverse Buddhist teachings that he is bringing together in the unity of breath practice, body breath practice. And he says to his assembly, the method of being fully aware of breathing, if developed and practiced continuously. You hear these little words? We skip over these words, don't we? So if we wonder, how come I'm not getting the results, you know, that the Buddhist assembly is getting? That all these disciples and that the Buddha is enumerating, all the results they're getting, right? These wonderful results. How come I'm not? Well, it could be on this little one word here. Practice continuously. Oh, that's... And again, we're humorous, but it's very important. This is not, this is, and this is in no way pass-fail. And this is no way to think poorly of yourself. It's just understand, that's all. I don't practice continuously, so I don't get good results. If I want good results, I'll practice continuously. It's kind of simple, isn't it, when you put it that way? Right? And then it's really a what? It's about us. Right? You know, and it comes back to those four successes, greens of successes, you know. How interested am I in it? How persistent am I in its practice? How wholeheartedly do I give myself to it when I practice? And am I kind of observing, you know, how it's doing, results, etc.? You know, do I have guideposts or whatever? And if our answer to those four is no, 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 right, then we go, well, then that's why I've not been successful. Right? Does that make sense? I mean, I'm sort of making it cut and dry to make a point, but I think it's almost is that cut and dry. And there's no right or wrong here, right? There's no bad good here. It's really about, you know, what does this really mean to me? How important is transformation to me? You know, how diligent am I in my uprooting the 10 hindrances from my mind so I am no longer knotted up by them? You know, again, I know in this assembly, like the Buddha's assembly, we're having our own little assembly here. We can call that the Buddha's assembly capital A. We can call our assembly small a in our small a assembly here. You know, we have people of different levels. People have been practicing for many years. People have been practicing for a few years. People who practice quite seriously. People who practice quite intermittently. I mean, we have a full range of people here, right? But the simple truth is, we all have this capacity if we want it. Right? You know, again, it may seem like a big deal to you. And again, I don't know where you sit that it might seem that way, but I can understand it may seem like a big deal to you. But let me assure you, it's not a big deal. It's really as simple as this, right? So if Susan Walsh wanted to learn how to play the cello, do you know how to play the cello? Susan Walsh could learn. I could look at Susan Walsh and say, I am sure, just looking, you have arms and hands, and you know, that you could learn to play the cello. Right? I can't guarantee that you'd be a great cellist, right? But I could pretty much guarantee that you could learn how to play the cello. If you were what?
Practiced.
If you were interested in learning the cello, if you were then willing to practice. If you were willing to practice at the level where you really could get some good results, and if you work with a teacher so you could get some feedback, I mean, we could say, yeah, Susan Walsh, who sits here having absolutely, being totally ignorant of playing the cello and absolutely saying, sitting here saying, I have no, if we put a cello in front of her, she would what? And she picked up the bow. I mean, all that would come out would be what?
Noise.
It'd be horrendous, right? Yeah, right. But we can sit here and say to Susan, if you practice in this way, blah, 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 a year from now, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years from now, we will be happy listening to you. You will make beautiful music. Right? I mean, does everybody understand that? Right? I mean, I could also say, you know, we had our two flautists this morning, and I could say, you know, pretty much, if any of you wanted to join them a couple of years from now, you could. It's just a matter of what? Are you interested? Are you curious? Do you want to develop yourself that way? Are you willing to practice? Persistent? Continuous? Wholehearted? Work with a teacher? You know what I mean, right? I mean, you know, 5 years from now we could have an orchestra. You ready for the tuba, John?
For your
like that, right? We could say string section over here and like that. It's really that simple. It doesn't mean that some of us may not have more innate capacities in music than others, right? So some people may pick it up better, quicker, right? It can be easier. Some may have to work at it a little more than others, but we can all do it. So it's like that. If developed and practiced continuously, will have great rewards and bring great advantages. It will lead to success in practicing the four establishments of mindfulness. If the method of the four establishments of mindfulness is developed and practiced continuously, there he goes again, that Buddha. It will lead to success in the practice of the seven factors of awakening, which we'll talk about tomorrow. The seven factors of awakening, if developed and practiced continuously, will give rise to understanding and liberation of the mind. Right? A, B, C, D. Is that clear? The only difference between us and the Dalai Lama and Thich Nhat Hanh and other great masters is simply they just follow directions. I mean, that's all. You know, but we kind of skip over words like continuously and persistent. You know, we just kind of skip over those words. We like the nouns. Maybe if somebody can write. Find a long piece of paper we can write continuously. We can take that from the Buddha. Maybe make that the watchword for a retreat, continuously. Bill yesterday was talking about ceaseless practice. It's same concept. We often hear that in Zen, ceaseless practice. Again, so we don't make too big a deal about this. For each of us, it is not now a perfect ceaseless practice. It is, can it be more ceaseless than it has been? That's all. For the rest of the day today, can my practice of mindfulness, can my practice of full awareness of the breath, right, be more continuous? Can my practice of being aware when a thought has arisen in my mind and not grasping it be continuous? Can my practice of when my mind has grasped at a thought, has grasped at an object, can my practice of letting go be more continuous, more ceaseless? It's like that. If we put it in absolutes, it becomes another way for us to defeat ourselves. It's really, again, from where I am, from where I'm practicing, can I be more ceaseless, continuous in my application of the practice? When I fall down, can I be a little more quick in picking myself up? That's all. When I lose the practice, can I just come back more quickly than I did before? I get better at letting go. What am I holding on to? Thoughts, feelings, perceptions, stories from the past, worries about the future, angers, resentments, stuff and nonsense. All of it. Right? Anybody disagree with me? Anybody want to stand up for rumination, constant rumination over the past? Anybody want to stand up for chronic worry about the future? Right? Anybody want to stand up for holding on to resentments and angers as long as possible? No? Anybody want to stand up for replaying miserable events from the past? Miserable interactions. We laugh, don't we? And yet, if we were honest, we would have to say what? And we do it. It's bizarre, isn't it? You know, because in a moment of clarity and rationality, we go, this is nonsense. You know, what am I doing this for? It only serves to create suffering. Right? And I'm putting all this energy into a place of wrongdoing, we could say. When we're supposed to be persistent in creating conditions of right doing and being very skillful in not supporting that kind of thinking, acting in the world. So if we practice seven factors of awakening continuously, it gives rise to understanding liberation. What is the way to develop and practice continually the method of full awareness of breathing so that the practice will be rewarding and offer great benefit? Can you see how the Buddha's teaching is very logical? Kind of just one builds on another, but another, very the way it's put together. It is like this. Now then he says, the practitioner goes into the forest, to the foot of the tree, deserted place, sits stably in the lotus posture, holding his or her body quite straight, and practices like this. So now we're right here at the door of practice. And this is where we all are. We're in retreat. So we haven't gone to the tree, even though during solitary practice you can certainly go to a tree, if you like, sit under a tree. But we go to a place of quiet. We take the posture. And the first thing he says, we begin with breathing in, I know I am breathing in. Or breathing out, I know I'm breathing out. And again, just for what we're talking about today, is this first tetrad, which deals with mindfulness of the body. Right. The Buddha first says breath in this teaching, and he will be restating that in all the 16 meditations. But the first thing is we establish this relationship with the in-breath and the out-breath. If that relationship is not even close for you, then as you breathe, you can even say to yourself, breathing in, I know I'm breathing in. And in that moment, know that you're breathing in. Breathing out, I know I'm breathing out. Counting your breath 1 from 10. Saying in breath or out breath. Or just being one following the breath. Right? The thing that links all those breath practices together is there's awareness, there's mindfulness, there's presence. Right? Is that clear? So that's our foundation practice for this retreat. We're gonna move off from that. But the reason that the Buddha, and really continuously, the teachers, do what they call samatha practice. First, there has to be this grounding, this stability, this calming and clearing of the mind. So we can then use the mind to investigate and explore more deeply the mind itself, feelings, emotions, phenomena. But first comes this stability, this clarity, this groundedness. And this can be cultivated. So we are breathing in and out in awareness. And we are breathing in and out in awareness of our body. And the fourth one is we are calming the body. So if we can talk about our practice until this evening, it will be this: to be present to our bodies, to be present to our breath, and to create ease and calmness within your body. Now, you may say, but I have a lot of pain in my body, especially from sitting. That may be the case. But that which is aware of the uncomfortableness in the body can be calm. This is very important. We cannot control everything. We cannot control, oftentimes, the pain and suffering and uncomfortableness that arises by us having a body. It seems to go with the territory. Actually, in traditional Buddhist teachings, the body is called a magnet for suffering. The body is a magnet for suffering, which means what? It's just pulling it. And, you know, I know Glennis could agree with that. Where's Sam? Sam, body magnet for suffering today? And there are other people here, I'm sure. Sandy, you know, in various degrees, there are many of us who can attest right today or at other times that this body seems to be a magnet for suffering. And you get over one and all of a sudden you think you're free and clear and all of a sudden some other suffering's attracted. That seems to be, that's why the healthcare industry is a booming industry in this country. The body is a magnet for suffering. Just the way it is. But even though the body is suffering, we don't have to suffer, do we? The mind doesn't have to suffer. So the first tetrad, breath, body awareness, calming, ease. We want to feel, this is kind of our, you know, the body is our home base in this life. Have you noticed in this incarnation, we all seem to come with bodies. Seems to be it's the way it's playing out in this realm. Seems to be a body realm. We sort of can't come into this realm without getting a body to go along with our mind. Right. So body and mind are one. So we, to the best of our ability, we want to be at home in our body and to find ways to develop ease in our body, even though we may have discomfort. So I know for some it's more difficult than others. When we are healthy and it's relaxed, it's easier. And when we're unhealthy, we have chronic pain or disabilities, it's harder. But that's why we practice. So that will be our practice through this evening. It's given to us by the Buddha. Okay, before we end, are there any questions about practice? Anything not clear about how we're to practice? At some point, did anybody hear a bell coming from upstairs earlier, about an hour ago? That was a test.